Short disclaimer. This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 16 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. All right, so we have a few announcements this week. We're going to try to keep it brief. We've got a lot going on in the show.
Mm-hmm.
So, the biggest thing this week, I guess we should just get right to it. Stars has decided to grace the West Coast of the United States with its first Outlander fan event.
They teased again. There was a teaser tweet.
Well, there was a tease tweet, and then they teased with a picture that was like the cutout standing in front of like the Hollywood sign.
Yeah, and like what? Someone joked, oh, well, maybe Sam is coming to L.A., and I thought, I mean, I get, maybe.
Y'all, I'd have been happy if that cutout was coming to L.A. I'd have been like, I want to take a picture with the cutout.
Oh, yeah.
I want the cutout. Hey, if that, somebody can get that for me for Christmas.
The Outlander fan event West Coast consisted wholly of waiting in line to take a picture with the cutout. That would have been cool.
And I think it would have been a long line.
Yeah, that would have been probably, yeah.
But I still probably would have waited in it. But it's way cooler than that.
It is so much cooler and totally unexpected and... again, not looking any gift horse in the mouth. Not a lot of notice there, Stars.
No. So, apparently.
But there was not a lot of notice for Comic-Con.
No, there never are. They like to throw these things at us last minute and just see how dedicated their fans are. I think it's almost like a test.
What's the date again?
The date is January 11th.
Which is a Saturday.
Yes.
And the next day, I believe.
Well, it would be the 12th on a Sunday.
No. Well, yes, the 12th, but that is also the date of the Golden Globes. So it doesn't surprise me somehow that given the fact that so much of the world entertainment media will already be in LA for that event, the short notice is like, oh man, okay, I'll do what I can. But the fact that it's the day before the Golden Globes is just too much of a Hollywood coincidence.
I'm happy either way. It's irrelevant to me when it is. I was going regardless. Or at least going to try to go. The invitation said, join us for an intimate afternoon with author Diana Gabaldon, executive producer Ronald D. Moore, and cast members Katrina Balfe and Sam Heughan. Panel discussions and Q&A with Diana, Ronald, Sam, and Katrina, followed by tea service at the Ebel of Los Angeles. And I guess what they wanted you to do was go to this website and RSVP, and of course I hurried over and did it. I had sent Ginger a text, are we registering? Are we going? What are we doing? And I didn't hear back from her, so I just went and registered.
And we are... gonna do our best to make it happen.
We got our
RSVPs.
We did get our confirmation.
And so now it's the rest is up to us to pull the stuff together on our own.
They made it sound like they did not accept or confirm more people than they could handle in the site.
But it was more than one evening. They did not say till the next day that
they had the cutoff.
Yeah.
So. My hope is that regardless of when we get there, there will be a seat. Even if it's a crap seat, I'll be happy to have a seat.
Oh, yeah.
But, yeah, so we're excited about that. That's less than a month away now. So I'm sure that we'll have plenty to get back to you guys about when we get done with that. We'll definitely be bringing our recording equipment with us so that we can...
Well, at least a phone, maybe. Of course, we, like any other fans, we'd want to... hear them, ask questions, speak with them, if at all possible, get pictures, etc. But also meet other fans. We're really excited.
Sure. We, obviously, our goal is to bring as much information to you guys as they allow us.
Anything?
So, yeah, we're pretty excited about that. I mean, we could go on with that for hours, but we're not going to. So, we also got, this was awesome. The Outlander site was updated this week with cast photos.
I mean, yeah, sure. The January thing kind of takes the cake this week. Do not get me wrong. But those images, oh my gosh. And oddly enough, the only image to bring tears to my eyes multiple times was Katrina. Because she is not as, I don't say conversational, but she's not as active as Sam is. And even Sam has kind of, cut back a little bit on his tweeting and all of that compared to, like, say, the summer. or before filming began.
Well, by that reasoning, then why wouldn't Tobias's pictures have done that as well? He says nothing on Twitter and has absolutely no interaction.
I understand. And that was the second thing I was going to say. So first, all the pictures were amazing.
The men were all very dirty, with the exception of Frank and Blackjack. They were all like covered in dirt.
One of the things that I noticed in looking at those character photos, the cast photos, was that I'm sure it's a combination of the fact that pretty much everything we've seen thus far were outdoors, right? In the elements, on the horses and that kind of thing. When you're outdoors, you're in the elements, and your lighting, you can do some stuff with lighting, but not as much as you can, say, in a studio, correct? Because you are at the mercy of the elements. The picture of Tobias as Blackjack Randall on the horse. I think he was on the horse. At least he was in uniform. The quality of the photograph was great, but it just looked, what I appreciated of it, which I think made everything more exciting, is that it looked gritty. You know what I'm saying? It looked real. There was no soft Oprah Winfrey show focus, lights, or filters. No.
Right, yeah.
It was not to make... I'm sorry. It was not to flatter them.
No.
And I mean that with the utmost love and respect, because I've seen pictures of Katrina's skin. It's gorgeous and glowing. In some of the very first images that we saw of her on September 11th when she was announced. But none of them, including Katrina, they look like normal people. They look natural, like you see the fine lines and the small wrinkles and just all of the character features. And I thought, that's awesome.
Well, I want to know why Colm gets to have hair and Dougal doesn't. They're both bald men. Shouldn't they have made the decision to not add hair to either of them?
Well, that's true. I was going to say, one doesn't necessarily have to do with the other, except that they are brothers in the show, in the story. So,
was it the caveat he gets for being a cripple?
Maybe.
He's like, you can have luscious hair because...
And his hair was like, wow.
There's a lot of it.
A lot of hair.
A lot of it.
This is the story of Jamie and Claire. Nothing can ever take away from that. But I think the most... Katrina's picture is the one that brought tears to my eyes a little bit. But the two that gave me a case of the feels were Blackjack Randall, not Frank, Blackjack Randall, Tobias in uniform, oof, and Galus. She looked gorgeous.
Here's the thing, though. What I think about Galus's photo is that she looked like there was something going on in that photo.
Yeah.
As opposed to the other ones, like both of the Frank and the Blackjack Randall shots kind of looked posed. And they kind of looked like they were just kind of like, hi, I'm getting a picture taken. Or it was like they were almost like dead straightforward. And Katrina's was kind of like looking up from what she was doing. But Galus looked like she was in trouble.
Thinking.
And she was scheming something. So I thought that was interesting that they made that choice.
I loved that shawl thing she was wearing that went over her head and around and on her arm. It was so pretty.
I mean, it was kind of Mary Magdalene in green.
Oh, no, whatever. It was very
beautiful. But it looked really good for hair.
And her skin and, yeah, so all that. So the photos were high, honestly, except for the fact that we do our best to attend this event. It's a close tie. Those photos were magnificent.
They were. So if you haven't seen them yet, you should definitely get to the Outlander Stars website and check them out immediately.
And don't miss don't let your excitement to see the cast photos let you miss the four landscape photos.
Yeah.
One, I guess mostly landscape. One landscape of a Scotland landscape that was gorgeous, of course. And then, it looked like the team of horses with Blackjack, everything from the back.
The soldiers, yeah.
Heading toward Lallybroch?
Oh, I don't know. They were headed somewhere.
And down the road, and
no good. If they were en masse, they were up to no good.
And there were two others. But anyway, so don't miss those.
Just check it all out. Spend some time there. I recommend it. Stars Outlander, their Instagram account, gave us a new image this week. To me, it looked like they were setting the scene for something with Uncle Lamb. There was a flashlight and an old-timey camera, and it looks like some sort of a journal.
But it is on a car. It's on the hood of a car.
It is on a car.
So, not that Uncle Lamb didn't have a car, but the car, we don't see a lot of it, so it could have been a 40s car. You never know.
You know what? I didn't even notice the car until you literally just mentioned it. But now that you say that, I'm like, oh, look, there's a windshield wiper and a steering wheel.
So, whether it's Uncle Lamb or whether it's Frank's stuff, it's...
Well,
Well, the reason
I jumped to Uncle Lamb was because of the instrumentation that's there. Because Frank, as a historian, to me, was always more interested in people and genealogy than Uncle Lamb, who was more interested in places.
Mm-hmm.
So when I saw the map and the journal and everything, it made me think of him because of his travels and things like that.
I wonder.
But it could be Frank as well.
It looks like, and I, of course, it could be extremely wrong. It looks like the book, we don't see anything. We can't see any. It looks like there's nothing written on top of it, right?
Mm-hmm.
And we see a flashlight and a camera.
Mm-hmm.
But it looks like a hand scribbled kind of map. The corners and the ridges it has, it almost looks like the battlement of a castle or an older building. So it makes me think maybe they...
I mean, it could be part of their day trip. I think that's what I mean.
Didn't they allude that they were going to be going to see Lallybroch?
One of the pictures on the stars page has them parked in front of
a
castle.
A car, yeah.
And it has both Frank and Claire standing in front of that.
So
from the back.
Was it the Dune Castle where they were recording as Leoc? Or was it the ruins, quote-unquote ruins, of Lallybroch?
I'm assuming it's... Oh, I don't know.
I don't know either.
I'm not going to be quotable on that right now.
Either way, that's why I when I think of this map that we don't know what it actually shows, but the flashlight and the camera make me think of going to look for something, going to search, going to visit. So definitely an outing.
Looks like Dangerous Women, the anthology that includes Diana Gabaldon's short story Virgins, debuted at number 18 on the New York Times bestseller list.
So congratulations to George R.R. Martin and also Ms. Gabaldon.
And all the other authors who contributed to that. And lastly, we noticed that the Emulsion Movie Twitter account tweeted that they were working with Tug Inc. The idea would be to bring Emulsion, Sam Heughan's most recent film, I believe, to the U.S. in multiple locations.
I don't know if it's more recent than the one he was filming in Norway.
That one's not out yet.
Yeah.
That one's not out yet, but this is the most recent that's been released.
That's been released, okay. There's not even a definite of whether this is going to happen, but what the Emulsion Twitter account said is that they were working with Tug Inc. Tug Inc. has been used in the past successfully to hold events and bring films to a certain area.
Well, I'm pro that.
Of course. And we would work with our local population, any others who were interested. Again, right now we have no information. But if this comes to be and they're looking at different sites, then of course we would be. We'll pass it on. I mean, I think they'll tweet it out to the world, but we would definitely like to help out in our own backyard.
Sure. So I guess that's about it for announcements. So without further ado,
Ms. Teresa Carl Sanders.
First, Teresa, we wanted to thank you for joining us today, taking the time out of your schedule to be with us here. And we wanted to chat with you, yes, about the books, which we'll get to in more detail later when we have you join us in our read-along. We're actually really looking forward to that, by the way, because you're the first guest who will have ever joined us for a read-along, so we're actually quite excited about that.
We're tired of hearing ourselves talk.
I listened to 3 or 4 podcasts from you guys yesterday, and I really enjoyed all of them, so I don't think you have any fears of tiring people out, or except maybe yourself. Occasionally, I get very tired of my own voice as well, so I know exactly that you're...
But yeah, for us and our own voice, yeah, I fully understand. So, in beginning our discussion with you, or beginning our chat with you, as we seem to call interviews, how did you come to find the Outlander books?
I came to find the books after a torturous episode of working for Federal Express, which is a great company, but it's not what I was put on this earth to do, I discovered shortly after starting work for them as an operations manager in downtown Vancouver. And I literally, after a really intense interaction, we'll call it, with a customer one day, I went for a long walk. And I ended up at the top of a bridge in Vancouver, which is a beautiful, beautiful view. And I ended up actually taking my cell phone out of my back pocket and dropping it off the bridge before I even realized what I had done. And that led me to go back to my office and phone my boss and tell him I quit. And 2 weeks later, after my last day, I walked into a bookstore for the very first time in probably 3 or 4 years. And there was this really bold black and red book sitting on the shelf. And it was Diana's Outlander. And I picked it up and I looked at the back and I said, time travel, wow, what a great way to get out of Dodge. I just need to get out of my head for just a little while. And I sat down and I read all of the books that existed at that time. And that was up to the end of Fiery Cross. And from there, Outlander in many ways influenced me to change my whole life. And so I'm very thankful for finding those books. And that was probably, 2003? Maybe even 2002.
Once you had found the books and you had, as you said, begun that journey in making those changes in your life, I believe one of those would have included your decision to go to culinary school.
That's right. The very first decision I think that was influenced by it was actually we made a move from Vancouver to where we live now, my husband and I, and we live on a small island just off the coast of Western Canada between Vancouver and Victoria called Pender Island, and we moved here. And then we were here for a few years before I decided that I needed to make a big change because it's hard to make a living on Pender if you don't want to do something in retail or in construction. And so I decided to go back to Vancouver and I moved it back in with my mom for 6 months and went to culinary school then. And that was in 2008.
I suppose your choice to go to culinary school while you had to go through the experiences that you did to come to that point to make that decision, culinary school was not a random choice. You say on your blog, you talk about early fond memories you have with your family and around the kitchen and good food. So had you ever thought of making a living working with food before, or had you ever even dreamed about culinary school before that decision was made?
I was actually signed up for culinary school when I was 19. And just before I had to put the deposit down, I had a complete crisis of life, another life crisis. Mm. And I had a long chat with my dad, and he was the major influence in food in my life. And he and I decided together that it was probably just better if I take a year off. And I did take a year off, and I did a lot of traveling. And then I took another year off, and I did some more traveling. And when I got back, somehow culinary school had sort of dropped off the map. And so I didn't pursue anything to do with the culinary arts, except cooking at home. I've always loved cooking at home. All my spare time is in the kitchen, even now. Sometimes it's just a matter of sitting with yourself for a while and remembering what drove you as a young child and what drove you as a teenager and a youngster. And when I sat and took some time to really think about what I wanted to do next, that's what came up. Culinary, cooking, it just kept coming up and I couldn't deny it anymore. I had to go back.
Isn't it interesting? You say that you allowed yourself to kind of be quiet with things, and you talked about how things seemed clearer, or at least certain thoughts, certain dreams you had as a child were so much clearer or easier to even accept maybe back then. And as we grow towards adulthood and we're finding our own identity, we're having these identity or life crises at different points. Things don't come as easily, and when they actually maybe could.
You're so right. Modern life is full of distractions and it's full of pressures. And I had some fears about when I was originally signed up for culinary school. Women weren't in professional kitchens very much back then. That was a long time ago. That was 1988, 89. And although it doesn't seem very long ago, it was still traditionally a man's world in a professional kitchen. And I think that's one of the things that really had me pause. And it never would have had me pause as a little kid. I was always the first one up the tree and always the first one playing tag and sports. But modern life, it changes our thinking sometimes. The fast, fast pace of life, especially now, doesn't allow us to sit and be quiet. And what we found on Pender Island here is that there's a lot of time to be quiet, especially when the power goes out. And slowing down life, even sometimes just for a weekend, slowing down life clarifies what's going on in your head.
Once you had gone to culinary school and returned to your island, I'm going to call it that. I'm going to call it your island.
My island.
I realized I just called, I like that. Once you returned to your island and the life, as you at least somehow had known it, you knew it would be different going forward because you had this new education.
Yeah.
I would guess then new plans. How did you come up with the idea, or at which point after culinary school did you have the idea for Outlander Kitchen or recipes inspired by these books?
I worked in restaurant kitchens here on Pender for about a year and a half, almost 2 years, before I just got to the same point where I had been in previous life. I'm not born to work for other people necessarily, I don't think. And I have trouble being supervised. So we'll leave it at that. So one day,
I think everyone has a little bit of that.
Absolutely. Everybody has a little bit of that for sure. And what happened was I decided that after my last job ended, I've always gone for long walks in the woods with the dog. And I was literally walking along one day, and I was probably in the middle of a reread of Outlander. And something just popped in my head when I was in the middle of the woods. And it was all about Voyager. And it was about those pigeons and truffle stuffed rolls that Claire and Jamie and young Ian have in Madame Jean's. And I thought to myself, wow, what a cool idea. I think I'll try those. And then by the time I'd reached the end of the trail in the woods, I had 5 questions that I wanted to ask Diana about food. And so I came back and I found her Canadian publicist via Google, and I fired them off that afternoon. And by the next morning, I actually had a response from Diana.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which was really, really cool. And it was a very gracious response. And she told me she'd be back with the answers to my 5 questions within the month. And she certainly was. She was in back probably within 2 weeks. And this is, I think, 2009. And it was right before Christmas. So it was right in the middle of the holiday rush. And I posted that on my other blog, which is islandvittles.com. And I got a really great response from the Outlander community. And it sort of grew from there.
So once you had that initial exchange with Diana, and then you had posted it on your other blog, since then, have you had the opportunity to meet Ms. Gabaldon or have any further exchanges?
I have. I correspond with her infrequently now. When I first set up Outlander Kitchen, there was lots of back and forth about getting permission and getting her consent and her support, which she's been amazingly supportive of the whole project. And we don't have a lot of need to talk very much anymore. But when we do, I fire off an email, and she's always gracious enough to get back to me within a short period of time. And her support has been really what's driven me along this path for the last almost 2 years now, over 2 years since I started Outlander Kitchen.
So how do you find your recipes that you choose? Are you strictly finding things in the book and getting ideas and then hunting down old recipes and spinning them so they're new, or are you strictly looking for old, time-tested?
I do a little bit of everything. I have a long diary that's full of every single piece of food that's mentioned in Outlander, whether it's actually being eaten or being thrown.
I'm sorry.
And there's actually some other uses of food in there that sometimes makes me think twice. And that I did with paper books. And then when I started Outlander Kitchen, my husband very kindly bought me a Kindle. And I think that without a Kindle, the project would be a lot more difficult because I can do keyword searches all the time. And a lot of foods are used repeatedly over and over. So it's a matter of finding the best quote or the best excerpt to go with them. I often peruse that list. And then I'll go for a walk in the woods, because I go twice a day, and dream about what it should be. And at the beginning, I was very pure about the whole thing, and it was going to be historically accurate and blah, blah, blah. But what happened very quickly on was you discover that a lot of historically accurate food is now unpalatable. It simply can't be eaten by modern taste. And as well, people don't have a lot of time to be in the kitchen anymore. And convenience foods are kind of taking over our diets, and I'd love to get more people cooking, and I think the best way to do that is to make the recipes adaptable to modern life and accessible for all sorts of cooking levels. So there's chicken fricassee in a few of the books, and I adapted that to the crock pot because it works really, really well in the crock pot. And I've got a few other crock pot recipes, I try not to use the microwave, but I've got one microwave recipe coming up probably in the new year. And then it's a good mix. It's a good mix of old and new. You know, I made Jocasta's bannocks, and I'll tell you, barley and oat bannocks are completely inedible. I've put them up on the website, and I've actually got a disclaimer that, wow, this is historically accurate food. Go for it if you want to, but I think you might be putting it in the compost. At the end of it. And it's interesting because then I put up a more modern bannock recipe, which are just absolutely delicious and gluten-free. A lot of historical recipes don't use flour. They don't use potatoes. They don't use things that we didn't grow until the sort of 19th and 20th centuries, which makes them more adaptable, again, for people and the varying diets that we all have now.
When you are working on your recipes, both those inspired for your website by the books, or at least tangentially related or inspired by, you also have your other websites and blogs. Outside of the books, what inspires you in the kitchen? What types of things in everyday life that you're surprised you're inspired by? How are you typically inspired in cooking and in informing recipes in general?
The most inspirational time of year for me is harvest time. So, you know, August, September. I'm a local food kind of person and I'm a whole food person. What really inspires me is getting myself and getting others excited about simple foods that most people can make at home without a lot of special equipment, without a lot of fancy accessories. And, you know, there's so many big machines and kitchen tools that are pushed at us in ads and on cooking shows that you simply don't need. What you need is a cutting board and a chef's knife. And standing in a kitchen for me with a chef's knife and cutting up things gets me thinking about what I want to make. So I might start cutting an onion without any real sense of purpose and move on to a French onion soup or move on to Jenny's onion tart. Actually started that way. Jenny's onion tart, I was slicing onions. I mean, I use food processors and things like that, but I really enjoy getting back to basics. And I think that's what inspires me the most, is trying to get other people back to basics in the kitchen.
So speaking of your recipes, have you had the opportunity to put down or publish a collection of your recipes thus far?
No. The best collection of my recipes are on my blog, so Outlander Kitchen.
Okay.
Diana and I have had discussions about a cookbook, and it just hasn't been the right time so far. I think what we might find is that the right time comes after the first season of Outlander, when everybody's gone crazy and it's such a big success that we can't do anything but publish a cookbook. You know, if you look at Game of Thrones, it has a food blog associated with it as well. And they
and they
published a cookbook shortly before the second season began. And it's been very popular. It's now been translated into German and I think probably a couple of other languages as well. So that's a good sign that we may find a market for the Outlander Kitchen cookbook as well.
I'm happy to hear the potential plan, if you will, but that sounds almost like the Game of Thrones cookbook. That entire process has almost laid the path.
I think Game of Thrones has really laid the path for the whole series because of how popular it's been, and it's kind of along the same scope as Outlander, with the long stories and the narratives and everything, and because it's been so well received, I think it really did lay the groundwork for the Outlander series to even be created.
Not as being conceived of, period, but to actually get this far in its production on such a channel. I think you're right, Summer. I think it took something like the success of Game of Thrones, successive seasons of success of Game of Thrones, and the what we have seen now and the fan community around Outlander. Every day we're blown away by extraordinary production team. How dedicated they are, how, and I mean this in a nice way, how obsessed they are with getting things right. And just seeing that every facet, from the writers to the costumers to the actors to the directors to the production, there's no facet that is not interested in being completely faithful. And seeing all of this is exciting as a fan, of course, but then seeing it and comparing it with the success of Game of Thrones, and we haven't even seen the first season yet, I think we're in for a marvelous, marvelous journey here.
I think so, too. And I think the other obvious influence on the production staff is Diana and her attention to historical detail and her research. And it certainly inspires me. It certainly inspires me to get it right. I've gotten one recipe. This is a funny story, actually. Very, very wrong. And that was from The Scottish Prisoner. And she had a big dish. And I looked it up and I Googled it and I found three or four versions of this dish throughout hundreds of centuries. And rather than going back to the book and really looking at her description, which is what I always do, instead I decided to wing it and I made this salad. And it was a massive salad. It had it was like kind of like what a Cobb salad is now. And I made up this big, beautiful plate and I posted it the next morning and it was absolutely fantastic. And I got this message from Diana saying, "That looks absolutely beautiful, but I don't know what it is." And one of the goodness. Most mortifying moments of my life was when we discovered that there were three versions of this dish and that I had picked the wrong one. Now, I will go back in time and make that dish again, but it's another hugely complicated dish involving duck and game and gravy and pastries and things. And that's one of those things that I do them from time to time now for fun, but I don't do a lot of those dishes anymore because they're simply not, most people don't have the time to recreate them. And so I'd rather have people cooking than reading what I had to say about my cooking experience.
So did you see the picture that Outlander Stars posted last week around Thanksgiving of the partridge pie?
Yes, I did.
Is that something you'd like to recreate?
I actually sent them back a picture of my hair pie, which is Jenny's hair pie from Voyager, suggesting that that was a little nicer. Birds with feathers on top of pies they just don't belong on my table. It was a pretty funny picture, but I would never, that's right up there with the Louis bird dishes from Dragonfly and Ever.
Baby pigeons with the, oh my goodness. Yeah.
No, and I'll eat a lot of challenging food. I'll try almost anything once, but that would be an exception. I would not be trying that.
Yeah, I couldn't do feathers. I couldn't do the feathers. Unless, like, it might make a good floss afterwards. I don't know.
Maybe more like a floss pick.
A floss pick. So out of the many recipes that you have created or recreated and posted about on Outlander Kitchen, what are some of your favorites?
Some of the ones I make all the time over and over would be the roast beef from the wedding feast in Outlander. That's a really good one. Stephen Bonnet's salted chocolate pretzel balls are another big popular one around here. My husband loves them, funnily enough. And that's one of the character-inspired recipes that I've done. So sometimes Scottish food can be a little bland, and especially historical Scottish food. So I decided early on that another way to make it fun would be to make character-inspired dishes and recipes. So Stephen Bonnet's salted chocolate pretzel balls take place right after Claire's visit to Dr. Fentiman when she discovers a testicle that's been pickled in Dr. Fentiman's collection. And that's where the tagline for that recipe is, one is never enough.
I was about to say, don't you make just one?
No, one is never enough.
One is never enough.
Even God makes sure everyone has two.
So we have a few questions that we'd like to, we have some time to include a few questions from some listeners, or at least people who
we
want
can't
to
guarantee
submit
they
them.
Listen. We can only guarantee that they are follow the
are
the
following,
Twitter
yeah. One was from Tweetly D, who has contributed before, and she asks, which book is your favorite for the food?
The best books to get food ideas from are The Fiery Cross and A Breath of Snow and Ashes, simply because they're on the ridge and you've got Mrs. Bug there and they're not on the move. If you look in the categories on OutlanderKitchen.com, you'll see that it's very heavy from The Fiery Cross and from A Breath of Snow and Ashes. But I'm inspired by all of them, and the time they spend in France is always inspiring. My culinary education is a classical one, so it's mostly French cooking. And the one that I would say actually the opposite to her question is the most challenging one, and that would be Echo. Echo is difficult because they're on the battlefield a lot, and so they're eating a lot of battlefield potage, which I don't think I'll ever commit to paper because it's a quick and hasty stew. Be called a hasty stew around here is what I would call it. And so it's a little light on the website is a little light on recipes from there, but I still pick through it and I still occasionally come up with an idea or two, especially a character-inspired recipe, because that's lots of fun to do. They're the ones that I really enjoy the most because they generally just pop into my head just like that. And then the development comes after that for a couple of weeks, but it's something I get to play with and think about for a period of time, which I love to do.
Another question, which we have addressed a little bit, comes from Marifel from Facebook. She asks, is Outlander Kitchen a food professional?
I am. I describe myself now as a professional chef and food and travel writer. So I spend all my time every day thinking about food, writing about food. The classical training that I have sort of gives me the confidence to label myself as such.
Okay, and Tracy, also from Facebook, asks, do you try everything you make? she has a difficult time imagining that someone would consume it, like the blood pudding.
Right. Blood pudding, I've never made blood pudding. Blood pudding is delicious. You just have to get beyond what it is.
Mm. I think seeing it made would make it very hard to eat, you know, like if you just had the end product.
Exactly. You don't want to be reading that description of Claire making it, sitting down for a full English breakfast.
Yeah.
But my husband is English, and so we spend quite a bit of time over there. And one of my favorite guilty pleasures is blood pudding in the morning. It just tastes like sausage. You'd never know. If I didn't tell you that it was blood pudding, you'd never know. It's just a sausage. I try everything. I would never put a recipe up that I hadn't tried and that I hadn't perfected. A lot of people, when I post, let's go back to hair pie. When I post Jenny's hair pie, I always get at least one comment that says I refuse to eat Bugs Bunny. And the fact of the matter is that we've become spoiled. There's very few bones in the meat department in the grocery store anymore. Most things are boneless. Most everybody thinks chicken is pretty much the best meat around. But, you know, chicken isn't really all that great for the earth. And eating one protein all the time probably isn't really all that good for our bodies. Whereas rabbit, heck, they breed like rabbit. They're really easy to cook. It's really, really delicious. Sometimes I try and get people to close off their mind and just focus on the plate that's in front of them. It certainly doesn't look like a rabbit. You'd never know it wasn't chicken. And it tastes a little bit like chicken. It's just gamier. And I try to inspire people to try different things, because new and exciting food can be really a great way to experience another culture, experience another time period without leaving home.
I'm glad you said that, because actually one of the things, I'm sure I'm not the first person ever in the world to say this, but something that I've always thought, that I came up with in my mind at least, is that reading books, especially Diana's, although the theme is time travel, reading books is, at least for now, our only true form of time travel. It's very magical. I'm glad you mentioned that.
Yeah, and you can take that magic into other parts of your life, into the kitchen, into clothing. There's lots of people walking around now with, I'm sure, especially after they air the first few episodes of the series as well, there'll be lots of people walking around with woolen accessories on and sporins. Hey, we may be bringing back sporins. Who knows? It's just an adventure. Opening up a book has always been an adventure for me, and I think anybody that enjoys Outlander has been, most of us are big lifelong readers, and it's the best way to explore new places without going anywhere.
And it's very affordable.
And it's even a hardback compared to a transatlantic flight is affordable, exactly.
And Tracy also asks, does she ever feel like just making a box of cheap mac and cheese, since she makes such fabulous dishes all the time?
I do, and I get that question a lot. Like, what what crappy food do you eat? And I'm certainly not perfect, and I'm not going to sit here and say that I would never eat Kraft dinner. But Kraft dinner is a family favorite, and my husband can't stand it. So when he's not in town, a glass of white wine and a box of Kraft dinner is one of my favorite guilty pleasures. So,
oh my goodness.
Yeah, and, you know, I'll admit I drive through the drive-thru occasionally for a side of fries. We don't have, here on my little island, as we like to call it, we don't have any chain restaurants. We only have one grocery store. We have a sushi restaurant, and we have a pub. And we have another little cafe, and that's it. So a lot of the cooking that I do, I have to do it at home, and I do it most of it from scratch. So which makes me, you know, a little bit different than your average urban dweller. But I certainly have my guilty pleasures as well.
So what wine would you pair with your craft?
It's always a cheap Sauvignon Blanc. Always.
But you have to keep in mind, you have a cheap blue craft box, and you have to have a cheap white wine.
It would be a wine crime to try and pair something with Kraft dinner. So I just go cheap, and I go to the refrigerated white section, and there you go. Sometimes maybe something a little fizzy, a little bubbly to go with it, but most of the time it's a Sauvignon Blanc.
I just got an idea, which we weren't prepared for, but hopefully we can do this on the fly. So I did prepare Black Jack Randall's Lavender Fudge for Tobias Menzies.
Yay!
It was so hard not to just taste the fudge as it mixing it, but it smelled divine on its own. It was very easy. Summer came over earlier today, and she had to take off for a bit before she came back, before we started, and I was making the fudge while she was gone, and she said, we're talking about making it, and I don't cook a ton, so I was a little hesitant. I was committed, but hesitant. And, or maybe anxious is a better word. And I said something like, well, Summer, here's the recipe. Look at this. This should be easy, right? She goes, ginger. It's like a paragraph long. It has like 5 ingredients. And 2 or 3 of those you sprinkle in.
Like, I think you got this.
Okay, I'll do it. So I had everything lined out. I took some pictures, and I'll put the pictures up when we post our blog.
Excellent.
They're not going to look as nice as yours. Of the ingredients first, a few steps along the way, just like 1 or 2. I was getting everything ready to mix, and I looked over, and my cat, who had been sitting on the edge of the counter, was sitting inside the wax paper lined pan. And yes, I took pictures. And I figured, well, chocolate will kill her, so she will not be able to share. But
she was a part of the
process.
She
apparently wants to be part of the show.
Totally.
So that was kind of a very dear picture, but of course I had to get new wax paper because I love Kitty, but I don't love Kitty that much.
No, exactly. And the wax paper made, you know, the cleanup easier of Kitty.
Oh, very much so. Exactly. So I washed out the pan, but still, it was pretty easy to clean up. Just take out the paper. So I prepared everything. I took a few pictures along the way, and I put it in the pan, in the non-kitty pan, and then put it in the fridge, and we took it out. But I was just planning on, which we still will do, on bringing out a piece or two for us to try here as we sit and speak with you. Our recent conversation about pairing white wine with mac and cheese is making me think, do you recommend any type of bevy with Blackjack Randall's Lavender Fudge?
Whiskey and chocolate go really, really well together.
Oh, my gosh. Okay, could we, like, put a pause on this, and I will go get some whiskey?
Absolutely. I never would have thought, actually, that whiskey and chocolate pair well, but we went on a distillery tour last time we were in Scotland. They had a whole tour devoted to chocolate and whiskey pairings.
I am back with my whiskey, including 2 or 3 or 4 drops of room temperature water, as advised. So I have a piece of Blackjack Randall's Lavender Fudge. I did the garnish as well. I'm very proud of myself.
Oh,
I never garnished, so.
Excellent. The garnish is always important if you're going to take a picture of it.
Oh, well, yeah. The pictures are done because now it's going to be chopped up and shared with friends and family. So it's pretty much, it's still pretty, but it's no longer whole. I have a few pieces here. Now, I've never done a tasting of any kind, like, of food. I've done whiskey tasting. Is there something you have done on the air? Like, do you describe it first? Do you just take a bite first, or?
I would take a bite first and then chase it with a sip of whiskey.
Oh, chase it. Okay, a sip, right? Not a...
No, yeah, no, a sip.
This isn't a college party.
Hey, now.
Let's get out the Jaeger and really get party.
Right? Woo! I almost didn't take my sip of whiskey because I was going to sit there and contemplate the flavors, but now as my throat is burning pleasantly... It's really nice. It's almost like they're... I'm not a plant expert, but isn't lavender in the mint family?
I believe you're right. They're all... A lot of herbs are all very closely related, so you're probably...
Okay, because
right.
It definitely... It's not a strong peppermint taste or anything, but just this... I don't know. It's just... It was an interesting...
It's almost like an astringent... I would describe it as astringent, so...
Yeah. I mean, it definitely is not overwhelmingly lavender, which is nice, but... And I love lavender. I love lavender pound cake, lavender iced tea. I don't care. I love purple and I love lavender, so this is fine. But this is very light.
It is very light, and I tend to tailor my recipes for the mainstream. Some people like a lot of lavender. Other people can't stand it at all. And lavender is one of those things, when you're cooking with it, you have to be very careful with it. Once you use too much of it, the whole dish tastes like soap.
Yeah, that would be kind of gross.
Yeah. I feel that way about cilantro.
Cilantro is one of those, you either love it or you hate it. There is no in between.
No, I haven't met a single person who's like, cilantro.
No, exactly.
It's always like, I love it, or, oh my God, it's poison.
And it is that dramatic, yeah. When you talk to an anti-cilantro person, it's a very dramatic conversation.
Ginger's taking a break to continue drinking her whiskey. She's like waving for me to keep talking. She's like, keep talking. Are you going to be able to talk after this?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I'll do my best.
Loosens up the vocal cords.
There you go. Oh, then this read long should be fun.
Oh, yeah. Oh, hey, now. Wait, did you say that what I think you said, that this is an appropriate one to have whiskey for?
Yeah.
No. Oh, I'm making that up. Okay. I'm hearing things. The stones are talking. No.
You sure that was water you poured in your whiskey?
Exactly. No, I think I poured whiskey in my whiskey.
Lord.
Even though we're here speaking about the books and the theme of the show is Scotland and all things Outlander related, oddly enough, I would never have thought to put whiskey with the fudge. I've heard of whiskey fudge, I will say, but I've never drunk whiskey and eaten fudge, so that was nice.
So would you say that a general base, if you're creating any kind of fudge, is just, because I noticed the recipe was really short and simple, it was mostly
chocolate and sweetened condensed milk with a little bit of, I guess, baking powder.
And I'll come clean and say, and I think I do in the post, that's a cheater fudge. So,
which I say thank you.
Yeah, and that's one of the, you know, I made 5 batches of real fudge before I decided that it was just too temperamental to expect people to get the same results that I was getting. And I've been trained, and I had 2 failures. I'm not a fudge maker, apparently. And I have all the thermometers and everything you need. And I still had trouble making it come out. And when I found a recipe using condensed milk, I just thought, wow, great. Everybody can do this. It's really easy and it's fun, right? That's what it's supposed to be. Outlander Kitchen is supposed to be fun. It's not supposed to be some maniacal chore that you make yourself do for 5 hours every Sunday so you can eat Outlander. That's not very fun.
It could be fun.
It is for me, but not everybody's quite into their kitchen like I am. So,
while looking at your Outlander Kitchen website a few times now, I've been reading about when you, I like how you put it, my Outlander Kitchen, how you take the readers through your quite small kitchen. I think it's lovely. I think it's lovely and inspiring that, yes, you have gadgets, but you don't need a huge, huge culinary restaurant kitchen to produce wonderful things.
No, you don't. And, you know, if you go into any professional kitchen in the back of a restaurant, except maybe the ones that you see on reality TV, most of them are cramped. Most of them are small. Most of them have maybe 4 square feet of working space per cook.
Wow.
And if you put out, let's say there's a 75-seat restaurant, you're probably putting out 150 dishes a night, and all the appetizers are coming off a 4-square-foot counter space, then you know that our kitchens now are too big. I get all fuddled when I'm catering or something and I'm doing work at someone else's house and I've got this massive island and, you know, your legs get tired walking around big kitchens. I've made, the picture is up on the website, I've made falafel and flatbread for 300 people in that kitchen and it actually works really, really well. You just have to be organized and clean as you go.
I think the layout is really important. Because I know that if you go into, like, IKEA stores, have those, like, life in 520 square feet, which doesn't sound like a lot of space. But I always walk into there, and I'm like, I could live in this 500 square feet.
If it were organized like this.
But most
exactly, and you put everything away every day.
Right. But exactly. Most places you go to live in, they're not laid out remotely in a practical manner.
No, and the most important thing in a kitchen is that your sink, your refrigerator, and your stove are in a triangle.
Huh.
If they're in a triangle, then everything is going to be okay.
That's kind of neat.
You're going to do a lot of walking.
Well, it's kind of an efficiency triangle.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, it's like opposite of the Bermuda Triangle.
So things could get lost in the middle, depending on how clean you keep your kitchen.
If you have a cat or a dog, like my cat, who is like perched or waiting for you to drop something, then it could be like the Bermuda Triangle because anything you drop will be gone.
Yes, my dog sits at the edge of my kitchen.
And he's lovely.
He's a lovely companion. He's with me all day. But he's always there for a drop piece of cheese, especially.
We are very happy that you agreed to stay with us, to join us on the read-along. And this week, we are doing Chapter 13, A Marriage is Announced. Chime in. Yeah, do not hesitate. Chime in. Tell us to stop. Tell us to hush. Tell us to give you the stage. We don't care. We want you. You're still our guest, and you're still someone we're featuring, even though we're going into the read-along.
Oh, well, thank you. This is actually one of my favorite chapters in Outlander, so I think it's...
Oh, how neat. Yeah. Oh, yay. Okay, excellent. So then we will expect a lot from you.
Okay.
You probably are more... Well, we never claim to be experts at all, but if it's one of your favorite chapters, and as you did tell us offline, you said that you are very familiar with it, so we have high expectations and are glad to have someone who can help us so much with this chapter.
Excellent. No pressure at all.
No, of course. Not here. Have you heard us? No. We just have fun and we have a laugh. Okay, so A Marriage is Announced. The chapter begins with Claire not feeling too hot. She has just been punched by Blackjack Randall, someone wearing the face of her beloved. And she says she's ill, but of course she probably feels something, but she's not feeling sick from the blow. She's feeling sick because of this disconnect between her feelings and her experience and her life with Frank, this person who is still her beloved, and someone wearing essentially the same face but treating her so wretchedly. And that is this disconnect that's making her physically ill. And that's how the chapter starts. She keeps thinking about the way that Captain Randall has been treating her. She can't make right of it, can't come to any peace on that. And Dougal, as she has come out of the room that's now serving as an office for the captain, Dougal goes up and talks to him, and the voices are here. You hear voices kind of shouting. And he comes back down and basically grabs Claire and is like, yo, we're out of here. And they go straight to the horses and they are getting out of Dodge, as you said. She almost has trouble keeping up.
And her skirts are flying everywhere. I love that visual. Exactly. Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, you would think that these huge dresses are like, you know, oh my gosh, these women were so bedraggled with all this weight and all this stuff. But it kept them warm.
Yeah. Well, they weren't for swimming, though.
Oh, no, that's true.
It was bad luck for her with water.
Not a good water attire.
No, he sinks like a stone in them. But exactly. Yeah, but the one question I've always had is she riding side saddle or is she riding full on? I think she can be riding sides. I know nothing about horses. I'm going to say that up front. But I don't think she can be riding side saddle and riding at a gallop. Mm. Can she? I don't know.
I think I think it must be possible. But I would think myself that they would have to be riding a regular saddle because they do not seem like the type of men to have a bunch of random side saddles hanging around. I think that she's riding somebody else's horse with somebody else's saddle.
See, I didn't even know that. So you have to have a special saddle to ride side saddle?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. Yes. So I would also say that it's very possible that she was riding astride or like a man.
Yeah.
And I never thought about it until you asked. I do know it was approximately about a century later, but in unrelated business, historically, I've done a lot of reading and, I'll say research, like an amateur historian kind of interest in a particular 19th century Austrian figure. And she was one of the most, touted as the most beautiful woman in the world at that time. She was the Empress of Austria. And she was also a renowned horsewoman. And she would go to Ireland and she would compete in these hunts. And she 100% rode side saddle. So I know that
Wow.
I don't know how much faster than galloping you can, or is galloping the absolute, because I'm not a horse person either. Is galloping just a full on ride? Okay. If that's what it is, yeah, she definitely, it's possible. But like you both have mentioned, I'm kind of iffy on whether or not they had a side saddle for her. I kind of doubt it.
And there's certainly no mention of a special side saddle. So
Exactly. Because if nothing else, I think we would have seen or experienced through the first person narrative. I think we would have experienced Claire having like a double take at what?
Exactly.
That would have been, I think, an interesting moment if indeed she had come across that. Once Dougal stops and pulls off and tethers his horse, and her horse is included in that, he basically kind of takes off through the brush. And this is where she's having trouble keeping up with him. He's a man on a mission going someplace.
With his Highland stride.
Exactly. Yeah. And she rushes after him because obviously she's here. She doesn't know her way around anywhere. And she finds him eventually having stopped at this spring.
Crosses himself, bent his head, and scooped up a double handful of water.
Yeah. She finds him there and she observes this and she sits down and she just goes for the water. She takes a drink. And one of the things that we see throughout their entire conversation is that at various points, Dougal kind of looks at her oddly. All of her ablutions, all of her things that she's doing with this water, whether it's drinking or wetting her small hand towel or kerchief and patting herself with it or on her décolleté, anything she does, Dougal is kind of looking at her with this, I take it as a kind of an odd quizzical look, or just he's definitely observing her throughout this entire conversation.
Yeah, and that's Dougal is what makes this chapter so enjoyable for me, because we learn a lot about Dougal, and he's a dastardly guy at times, but a lot of the time I think his motivations are true. And they're mm-hmm. from a good place, and I like it here because he's really protective of Claire at the beginning of the chapter, and then he becomes protective of Jamie, even though we learn later on that he's not really always protective of Jamie. But you see the fatherly side of Dougal in this chapter, which I think is really nice.
That is the most interesting, is seeing the various facets of Dougal, but seeing so much of him at all, because yes, he's in a lot of chapters before now, but this is truly Dougal's chapter. And I'm sure they will do just fine adapting this to the series. But I really look for it. And I say this every week, so it may have lost its meaning. But every time something, I look forward to this. Oh, I look forward. Well, you know, darn it. We're going to look forward to every moment. I really look forward to, because we don't have a lot, up until now, too much insight into him.
No.
And we have a lot of moments with Claire and Colm. And when they have their meetings in his office, we have a lot of moments between her and Jamie, and even her and Ned. We haven't had a lot of at length moments with her and, or was I should say with Dougal and anyone.
I always thought of Dougal not being a man of words. He's the man of action. Colm is the man of words. Ned Gowan is not really a man of action either. He's a man of words. So this is probably the most verbose we see him in the course of this book.
Absolutely. You're totally right. Yeah.
And then Dougal asks her something about Jamie's back. Before he talks about the actual floggings, he basically says, you know, you've seen his back. You kind of know what happened. And she's like, well, yeah, of course I've seen it. You know, he's talked about it in not too much detail, but he has, of course, mentioned what happened in general. And this is the first time where I stopped reading and I looked up at Summer and I said, this made me laugh. Dougal laughed shortly and wiped his wet hand through his hair. Our Dougal has no hair.
This is not the first mention of hair. A couple chapters before, it was made some mention of his long russet hair, and I was like, oh, guess we're not getting that in this series.
Because Graham McTavish, he's extremely attractive.
He totally
but
is, yeah.
He has no hair. I mean, I don't care. I find Patrick Stewart ridiculously attractive, so hair is not a must-have for me as far as attraction goes, but it's just funny reading that and going, yeah, well, maybe not.
he'll run it across his shiny bald pate, perhaps.
Exactly, his shiny. They might go. No, I'm just kidding.
I'm sure I'll have it wet.
That wasn't very nice. I apologize, Graham. So things like that, when I'm reading along, trying to get the content, trying to take some notes for discussion, and then a line like that will just make me burst out laughing.
It's a good point about how though movies and TV adaptions change the visual that we have in our head.
Exactly.
And I still have a visual in my head, but I can feel it fading for some characters as the cast takes over. And I think they've done such an amazing job with the cast that I'm really not worried about it. But, you know, that's the difference between people who have read the books before this series comes out and people that will be drawn to the books after they've seen the TV series. They'll have, they'll have bold pictures in their head of casting, whereas we may still have some echoes of what we always thought they looked like in our
own
heads.
That's true. And it's not just the having read the books and then coming to the series after reading the books. It's not just the casting, which I agree is perhaps the strongest images that we have is of these characters because we follow them along for however long we've read the books. But also when we read, it's not just the people and the characters, it's the scenes and how we see them in our mind.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, even though something is described, I presume that my set is different than the set that you see in your mind, just because we all have such powerful imagery in our own minds. And so it's not just pictures of the characters we have. It's also we are our own producers in our mind, our own set directors. Our brain fills all of these details in.
Absolutely. That's a really good point. Yeah. And I heard someone, or actually I read on Facebook, someone said that, you know, it's two different stories. There's the book story, and then there's the TV story. And if you keep that in mind as this process goes along, then you won't be upset because it's the TV story that they're doing. They're not doing your book, your particular book story. They're doing a version of a television story. And it's going to look different than what it does in our head. It just can't help but be different.
Exactly. And to that point, even the answer to this question is very personal. I can definitely see both sides. For me personally, the answer to the question, would you have rather read books before you watch an adaptation for film or screen, or knowing you had the choice at any time to do both, watch the filmed or screened version followed by the books? If I have a choice, like with Game of Thrones, I didn't have a choice. I had never read them, but I wanted to watch the series, so I did, and I've liked them, and now I have interest in actually reading them when I have a moment of time. With the books, again, I found them over, 13 years ago, so I haven't, there's been no choice. But I have had times where I have had the choice. A movie's coming out and put the choice to watch the film or the TV series off until I have a chance to read because that is how I personally prefer to handle things. I can handle watching an adaptation, understanding exactly your words, I can keep them separate in my mind. That's how I am able to enjoy and completely, completely enjoy True Blood. I read the book first, and the series is like, what the wah? It's so completely different. I had to split it.
You had to realize that that one is based on the book series. It is not the book series. Like, they followed it for, like, maybe two seasons. And then they were like, hey, this is boring. We're going to do our own thing.
But I think you make such a great point, Teresa, is that even in a situation where I think we're in now, where they owe us a good experience of being entertained.
Yep.
Of course, we as diehard fans hope that we are entertained in the process of having a somewhat or fairly faithful adaptation. Of course, we would all say that. I definitely think the whole read first, watch first, that's a very personal decision, which I can definitely see both sides. But as far as keeping them separate, I think you make a very good point, because it's my ability or my choice to keep those separate that allows me to watch something. And especially since I do prefer to read first, I think coming into it, I could be very scared. I could approach this entire series with an, oh my gosh, is it going to ruin it for me? It won't, because I've lived with these books for 12 or 13 years, and I know it won't, because I've already loved them. They will not change that. So
no,
I think
that's a good point. I've seen a few people that are making comments on Facebook and Twitter that are very, very anxious about this adaptation. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I've got other things in my life that make me more anxious. And I just want to be entertained, like you say. And I think they're doing an amazing job before we've even seen an episode of keeping us entertained. So I have great, great faith that it'll be different, you know, and everybody's going to have one or two niggly things that they don't like. But overall, you have to look at the big picture. Overall, I think it's going to be fantastic.
I agree 100%. And that's what I'm excited about the show coming out is, number one, that it exists at all. Number two, the production team almost at every point is made up of such committed fans themselves that watching it is going to be a joy. So, okay, so back to the chapter. So Dougal basically recounts the flogging, the two floggings that Jamie had, that he had the opportunity, although that wasn't a fortunate thing, to be witness to. And Dougal asks her if she's ever seen someone being flogged, and she says no, but he says, you can actually hear the flesh being torn from the body. And I thought, I wrote the word yuck. I mean, what else can you say? That's bull. I don't even know. That's gross.
It still makes me shiver, and I've read these books a long time. But I was reading it again this morning, and that gave me pause, and it made me shiver.
I think it's even worse the second or third time through, because you know more about Jamie,
and you're really
and you care about him.
And you're concentrating on details rather than a broad story. Absolutely.
In his description, he talks about the first flogging and then the second flogging, when Captain Randall kind of finds out that he seems disappointed that the flogging was done without him there, or without him he wanted to do it. And so he either remembers
he creates a reason,
but he didn't create the thing that happened. He just used it for an excuse to have a new. Yes. He uses the detail that while he escaped, he had bread and cheese with him.
He pulled a Valjean.
He pulled a Jean Valjean. Well, Jamie did, yeah. He uses that as an excuse to do a second flogging, this time instead of 100 lashes. This was kind of ironic that we have you here as our guest chatting about this chapter in particular. I thought, would you have, this is very probably very crass, but would you recommend a type of bread and cheese to escape with?
Well, it's always got to be a French loaf if you're having cheese, I think. Or maybe a ciabatta would be quite nice, too, wouldn't it? And something aged, something like an Emmental or a Gouda. I don't know. I saw this really weird ad for spreadable brie this morning, and it's thrown off my whole picture of cheese. And my husband and I looked at each other, and I said, you know, like, what the heck was that? And he said, brie without a rind. And I just thought to myself, wow, the world of cheese just went down a notch.
Oh, for me, I cut that right off.
One thing you can't have when escaping is spreadable brie, but regular piece of brie, hey.
Oh, I love the rind.
I'm always surprised you didn't have a bottle of wine with him, but, you know.
That's true.
When you're under pressure, you can't have everything.
Exactly. Of course, we hear about the second flogging. The garrison doctor is like, he needs to at least be healing for a week before you go to the second flogging. So, I mean, there's humanity in that, but I don't even know what side is better. Yes, I'm happy Jamie didn't die, or we would have no more books, but we would have no story. But, I mean, what's better, to flog him and kill him, or to allow him to heal so that you can do it again. I mean, they're both twisted.
Well, yeah, there's no doubt. We learn here that this is where we learn what Diane is talking about him being a psychopath. Right? That's mm-hmm. what he is. He has no sense of guilt. He enjoys inflicting pain on others. And
masochist?
Yeah, sadist. He's a masochist.
Sadist.
He's a psychopath. He's a masochist. He's all of those things. And Claire got a glimpse of it, you know, when she looked into his eyes just before Corporal Hawkins helped her stand up after Black Jack Randall mm-hmm. punched him. And Dougal refers to that kind of nature as well here. And Diane is really setting us up with repetitive instances of this behavior and its foreshadowing of what is yet to come, really.
Absolutely. And after he describes the second incident of flogging, he basically says, look, Claire, I'm telling you this. So that he takes a step back. I'm telling you this so that you can see not only Captain Randall's character, but also so that you can see a bit more about Jamie's character. Because so much of the description is about this terrible, terrible event, which it is. But also, I mean, little bits of Jamie's character. Number one, he has the spirit and heart and body probably of a warrior. He is ridiculously able. He's able to go to the utmost physically. And he does faint during the flogging, but one of the faints is a faked faint. So he's able to go, I mean, further than probably most people. What is it he says before? This made me laugh too. Just before the second flogging happens, the captain is taunting him. He's talking to him about, we're going to do this, etc. And it's a cold morning. The narrator, Dougal, is already talking about how cold Jamie was, and he was shaking a little bit from the cold. And Jamie says to Dougal, look, can we just get this over? I'm going to die of freezing before I die from anything you do to me.
You didn't say to Dougal.
Oh, sorry.
To Randall.
To Randall. Not Dougal, Randall.
I was like, what just happened?
What just happened? complete change of scene. And that just tells you he's definitely got gumption.
Yeah, he's got a good pair, doesn't he? And he's...
Claire has a pair, too.
Claire has a pair. They all...
You haven't dedicated any recipes to his.
Don't tempt me.
Summer. So, basically, Dougal's trying to say that, look, I'm telling you this to expand upon him and both of their characters. And he says, I have been ordered by the captain to bring one Claire Beecham to Fort William. And he says, look, this is what I've been ordered to do, but I can offer you a way out. And she's like, well, of course. And we find out, da-da-da, to marry young Jamie. And she kind of flips out, not because necessarily of the prospect, but just because she's like, the thought of being forced into marriage when she was just torn from her marriage, basically. So I can definitely see it. On the one hand, like her, she wants to save her life and not go back to being punched or potentially worse when she's being questioned. And also, you know, how much say does Jamie have in this? So she's in a tumultuous situation there. And Diana describes that very, very well. Of course, the way out is for her to no longer be an English woman. And the only way to do that is for her to become a Scot.
Absolutely. And with all the other things going on in that scene, I always think, too, she must think to herself, you know, a woman is a possession in those times. Mm-hmm. So it's not only a scary prospect to marry somebody when she's already married and all the moral stuff with that, but also Jamie seems to be a nice guy, but is he really going to be that nice once he's got his possession, once he's got his woman?
Exactly. And then he's like, well, okay, I guess you could, if you're so anti-Jamie, I guess you could marry Rupert.
Poor Rupert, man.
Poor Rupert.
Poor Claire. She had to marry Rupert. Holy.
Yeah, I know. That's that too. So she's like, maybe not that one. She says to Dougal, you know, well, at least now you believe you believe I'm not an English spy. And he's like, well, now I do. And she's like, huh? And he then points at the spring and describes it as the Saint's Pool, basically, St. Ninian's Spring. And that, according to legend, people that drink from it and then speak can only speak the truth, because otherwise, to do otherwise would be damning them to hell. And what also made me laugh, and he mentions gizzards, but gizzard would be burning or rotting. And she's like, my gizzard's just fine, thank you.
Well, but the fact that it's the St. Ninian's or Ninian's Spring mm-hmm. explains why he was so...
Yes.
Weirded out by her ablutions, because, you know, it's this holy place, and she's like cleaning her armpits in it.
Totally.
Yeah, I think that's going to be a very... I'm sorry. I hope. I'm pretty sure they will, but I hope they keep this scene, because that's hilarious. It's important to number one, it's how we find out, at least in the books, that the proposed marriage, but also this whole this whole thing of Claire just taking the water and doing her thing. And yeah, it makes me laugh. Dougal confirms that is part of the reason, besides the collection and then having a legal person there, that's part of the reason that Ned was brought along, because he said he thought it may have to come to this. And so then she thinks to herself, you know, wow, this not only is this kind of news to her, she's like, wow, you know, how much forethought have these people been having about this certain situation? How long has this been going on, since the day I was brought to the castle?
Well, you'd think so, yeah. Certainly is a complicated time to live in, eh? And mm-hmm. and I think most of us would be dead within about 10 minutes with all these machinations going on. So
exactly. And then she's, invited, brought into the room or to the situation to sign the marriage contract.
Right.
And she asks to speak with Jamie first alone. And in this conversation, we had to include this in our discussion, come perhaps, at least in my estimation from everything I've read and the different fan sites and everything, perhaps the most well-known lines of any of her books. And that is, as she is trying to find a way to kind of talk her way out of it or find a way to get Jamie on her side, if you will, about not having this marriage, she says, "Does it bother you that I'm not a virgin?" And of course he replies, "As long as it doesn't bother you that I am." Those are some of the most well-known lines and of at least Outlander.
Oh, for sure.
And
yeah, it's certainly one of the more striking lines where I remember thinking, oh, wow.
Yeah, that had me thinking.
A 23-year-old man, that's an unusual thing in those times, is to have a
virgin. Oh, yeah. I mean, in today's times, of course, but even back then, absolutely.
Yeah, yeah. A woman would never have given up her virtue, I would imagine, but a man mm-hmm. would have been expected to sow his oats, so... Yeah,
exactly. Yeah. And then basically I wrote my note. Claire gets her whiskey on. Claire, she pretty much is like, okay, look, she signed the contract. Jamie's like, maybe not happy as a clam, but he doesn't seem too bothered by this whole thing. He's like, yeah, okay, that's fine. We'll work it out. At least someone needs to know what they're doing.
Well, and he was like, who else is going to take me? I'm not worth having. He's like, no father wants to marry me. I've got, you know, a price on my head. I'm, you know, scarred up. Can't even tell you my real last name. I'm not worth having, so why not?
So yeah, I at least I get to fix the whole virginity problem, so why not? So Claire is like, they thankfully give her, I guess, her one last night, her one last time to herself, and she goes to the bar, and she has whiskey, and Duke was like, dude, just give her some. Because the guy makes eye contact like, are we supposed to be doing this? And he's like, just do it. So she has...
She drinks herself into oblivion.
She drinks herself into a nice little,
She sure does.
The chapter actually ends with her passing out.
And talking to the fly, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yes, she has fly conversations. So she hears, before she kind of passes out talking to the fly, she hears in and amongst the background noises, she hears some raised voices with Jamie and others. So she gets the feeling that while Jamie definitely has no hard feelings toward her, or maybe even against this marriage, or against having to do this to save her, he maybe isn't exactly thrilled with what's going on either. Maybe it's because I get the feeling it's not on his account, but I get the feeling it's on her account.
Gotcha. Yes. And we learn later that it is definitely hers, but on her account that he's fighting. But
yeah.
Yeah, but it certainly makes you wonder if he really is as agreeable as he pretended to be upstairs just a few minutes ago. Yeah.
Yeah, and then it ends with her little conversation with the fly when she can't really say the word chance. Your chance. Yeah, so this was it was a very, very interesting chapter. Yeah, I think the best way to sum that up is that we see so much more about Dougal. I'm glad you said that, because I think that this may be the most we see of him at any one opportunity.
You're right. Yeah, it really is. It's certainly in Outlander, and it's certainly the most sympathetic portrayal of him, because he has been thinking about how to save Claire since he found her, since mm-hmm. Murtaugh brought her into that little bothy at the very beginning of the book. So it always makes me, whenever I have Dougal moments where I'm really not liking the dude, I go back to this chapter. And remember that although he's always thinking of himself and his brother, he does have some softer moments too.
It's a very nice insight into him. And I'm glad you said that, you know, whenever you reach a point where you're kind of frustrated with him, you can come back here and see another side of him that he's, Even though, yes, the plan of the marriage is probably first and foremost to save Claire, right? That's like the most, that's the first thing that they're trying to worry about, to save her from having to go see Captain Randall. That's the first thing. But he also, I think their little chat at the well, besides the whole, you know, it being a holy place and she supposedly won't lie after she drinks the water. Besides that, he really is, yeah, you can see how he cares for Jamie, but I think he also is showing that he kind of cares for Claire, or at least he knows to a certain extent, because yes, women are property. He is trying, in the way he knows best, perhaps, to get her into this whole proposition, maybe not smoothly, but more, a little more kindly.
Yeah.
To show her the badness of Randall, which she kind of probably could have guessed. But also the more about the character of Jamie.
Yes, he stands well. He describes Jamie well and very sympathetically, I think, and really sounds like an uncle. For one of the only times in that whole book does he sound like he's actually a proud uncle of Jamie, because there's a lot of Jamie's actions in those descriptions to be proud of.
And that's true. You know, sometimes I forget that they are blood relatives, because they're no, I do. I'm glad you said that, because you just think of, you know, Jamie, Dougal, Colin, that there is, he's part of their clan, but that whole, the uncle,
well, there's
nephew.
A lot of tension between them, because a lot of the things they do are in effect a way to neutralize him.
Yes.
Yeah.
So it's like, it's a tough thing to be in, because he's part of his own clan. Mm-hmm. He's the head of his own clan, but we don't really get to know that yet, but he's part of his own thing. But he's currently with them, and because he's also family to them, he could stand to have a standing with them, too. So it's kind of like they don't really – everyone's trying to figure out where he should be, where he could be, and where they want him to be.
And it does help me. I think we get into this a little bit later in a further chapter. But a side note, of course, is that it helps neutralize Jamie, not necessarily in his stance in the clan, but it may help some of the other fathers – feel good about their daughters now have no chance with Jamie. So, or would have no chance if he goes through with a marriage with Claire. So it does not neutralize his potential, I guess, threat to the clan as a blood relative male, but it kind of does neutralize him as far as him being able to marry into the clan once he marries not just another, a different person from a non-clan woman, but an English woman at that.
Absolutely. Yeah. And he, and as it says, he's no longer, nobody's going to back him to take over Clan Mackenzie if he's got an English wife.
Exactly. It saves Claire. It neutralizes Jamie as far as other fathers having to worry about that connection. But it actually kind of protects Jamie as well.
It does, very much so. The one interesting thing I think it also does is counterintuitive to the way Dougal thinks, is that it actually ensures that Lollybrock never falls into their hands. I've wondered from time to time if Dougal thought that all through, or is he just acting on the spur of the moment and what he's been thinking about up until now, but without that consideration of Lollybrock, because as Jamie says later on, it belongs to her if he should die.
That's absolutely true. And that's, I honestly did not even consider that during this entire read-through of this chapter. We can see all of these pluses, and that's an even bigger plus for Jamie. And then, you know, okay, in the event of his untimely death, it's even better for Claire, because it gives her not just protection from the English, but also societal standing as a lady.
Absolutely true. I didn't even think of that. You're right. Yeah.
So you helped us, and then hey, that's really awesome. So there are so many things that, besides just saving Claire from that one potentially, and we never know how it would have been because it didn't happen, the potentially life-ending, definitely life-altering meeting had she ever been forced to be in Randall's charge.
Yes, and I think that it points to why we all read these books over and over and over. Because every time you read it, even if it's on the 10th or 11th time, you still find something that you hadn't thought of before. Or it sparks such great discussions between longtime fans, because you do get these points of view that you've never even thought of before.
Exactly. And that's why we are so excited not only to have you here as our inaugural guest for the read-along, but also for the future. I could sit here and do it. Summer could sit here and do it on her own. But it's just like, it's a monologue. And even if we spark ideas as we talk, it's still a monologue. So having the two of us, it's nice. We definitely bounce ideas off, and she makes me think of things in a new way or adds. But having a third person, and not just a fan, but a longtime fan who has been reading these books also for quite a while, it's you, as you say, you have the experience of not just being a reader, but a multiple time reader. and the insights that we can all bring. And anyway, so it's a third voice. It really sparked some new thoughts for me on this.
Well, I've had a gas today, and I want to thank you both for inviting me on, and because it's really been a lot of fun.
Well, thank you so much. We've also had a wonderful time today, and we hope that if and when the time comes after the first season, when we look forward to hopefully many more seasons of Outlander, that you will come back and discuss your book.
Well, if it comes to be, then I'd be more than happy to discuss my book, but I'd be happy to join you guys and discuss anything about Outlander.
Oh, well, open invitation then.
We can dissect the TV series until no one wants to listen to us anymore.
Exactly. That's what we say, basically. So basically, once the series starts, then our discussions are about the series. And then in between, it's about the book. So it's all one big happy family of Outlander Scotland stuff. Thank you so much for joining us. This has been one of the most fun discussions we've had. And of course, having you here, allowing us to interview you and just chat.
My pleasure to both of you. Ginger and Summer, it's been great. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
Well, that about wraps up the 16th episode of the Outlander podcast. Thank you again, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous audio host, audioboom.com. Our audioboom channel is www.audioboom.com/channel/Outlander Pod. Visit our website at www.outlanderpod.com. Follow us on Twitter at Outlander Pod. Find us on Facebook at www.facebook.com/Outlander Pod. Or email us at outlanderpod@gmail.com.